very simple. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, say something, do something, get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy. A collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates, focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I'm your host, Hamid Khan. On today's show,
we see workers that are constantly paid a piece rate which equals $6 to $7 an hour.
We'll look at sweatshops in Los Angeles, which are still open amidst the pandemic. But now they are making masks.
And these corporations have decided that if they're going to connect with a younger generation that is not only less white than older generations, but also more left-wing, less tolerant of intolerance.
And then a certain Washington, D.C. football team finally faces a name change after years of pressure over anti-Native American racism.
All that funding and support for corn drove land out of the more nutritious crops like sorghum and sweet potato, key staples that offer far more nutrition than corn.
And food scientist Timothy Wise says the coronavirus has brought into question the neocolonial green revolution for Africa. This and much more in today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. But first this.
When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, stand up and say something, do something.
Representative John Lewis was a leader and organizer of the civil rights movement, who coordinated and spoke at the 1963 March on Washington. Was beaten by police as he marched for voting rights in Selma in 1965, and was instrumental in getting major anti-discrimination legislation passed.
When my seatmate Albert Bigelow and I tried to enter a white waiting room, we were met by an angry mob that beat us and left us lying in a pool of blood. Some police officers came up and asked us whether we wanted to press charges. We said no. We come in peace, love, and nonviolence. We said our struggle was not against individuals, but against unjust laws and customs.
John Lewis represented Georgia as a U.S. congressman since 1986 and became known as the conscience of the Congress.
So it doesn't matter whether we're black or white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American, whether we are gay or straight, we are one people, we are one family, we all live in the same house, not just American house, but the world house. And when we finally accept these truths, then we will be able to fulfill Dr. King's dream to build a beloved community, a nation, and a world at peace with itself.
He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last year. He leaves us with a lesson. If you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have the moral obligation to do something about it. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's special national broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Hamid Khan. 14 years ago, the Bill and Melinda Gates and Rockefeller Foundations launched the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, with the stated goal of doubling productivity and incomes by 2020 for 30 million small-scale farming households while reducing food insecurity by half in 20 countries. An African and European civil society alliance has just published False Promises, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, which concludes that the number of Africans suffering extreme hunger has instead increased by 30% in the foundation's focus countries. Pacifica's Ann Garrison spoke to Timothy Wise of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy about what really happened.
Tim Wise, you refer to, quote, Rwanda, Africa's hungry poster child, unquote, as a nation that agri counts as a success, even though the people there are hungrier than ever. In 2010, I spoke to then presidential candidate Victoire Ingabire before she went to prison for the next 8 years, and she was very concerned then, as she is now, that this agricultural policy has made rural Rwandans hungrier than ever. She says that traditional subsistence crops have been sacrificed for cash crops, which mostly benefit elite urban traders. Do you agree? And is this a problem in AGRA's other 12 target nations?
That's an interesting reference you make to the former presidential candidate. She was exactly right. That's exactly what's come to pass. Under Agriculture Minister Agnes Kalibata, Rwanda and AGRA focused on increasing corn production. They did quadruple corn production with subsidies and authoritarian measures such as fining farmers who failed to switch to corn. But hunger remained high. And with the number of hungry Rwandans increasing by 500,000 in this same time period, it's hard to see why this was a success. Why did that happen? All that funding and support for corn drove land out of the more nutritious crops like sorghum and sweet potato, key staples that offer far more nutrition than corn. And that leaves farmers more vulnerable to climate change. As their soils degrade, they lose crop diversity, which undermines their family's diet diversity. Kalibata herself rode her supposed success in increasing corn yields by 66% to become head of AGRA. But our report shows that overall staple crop yields increased a meager 24% in 14 years. AGRA promised to double yields, 100% increase.
What else would you like a lay audience to understand about this now?
Well, our food systems are at a crossroads. Climate change and now the coronavirus have highlighted the fragility of long supply chains, the dependence on imported seeds and fertilizers in developing countries, and on fossil fuel-based agriculture like we have in the United States. All those fertilizers are manufactured heavily with fossil fuels. The last thing we should be doing is trying to export that failing model of agriculture to Africa right now. Our report shows that the effort is failing on its own terms, weak productivity growth, and rising hunger. African farmers want something different, and I heard that when I was researching my book, Eating Tomorrow. Groups like the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa are demanding a shift in all that support for failing Green Revolution policies to ones that support local farmers, improving their native seeds, using lower cost, lower input practices. Lots of studies have shown that such practices generate higher productivity increases while increasing farmers' incomes and food security, exactly what AGRA is failing to do.
That was Timothy Wise of Boston-based Small Planet Institute and Minneapolis-based Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. In Berkeley for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Scientists continue to discover novel ways to test for COVID-19. From Ames, Iowa, Pacifica producer Ursula Rudenberg files this report.
With shortages of tests being an ongoing problem, one laboratory at the University of Iowa took matters into their own hands and developed a take-home, self-administered COVID-19 test based on spit. I'm Ursula Rudenberg in Ames, Iowa. I spoke with Dr. Val Sheffield, director of the Interdepartmental Research Program in Human Molecular Genetics at the Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences Department at the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine. When the pandemic started, Dr. Sheffield realized that testing he conducts for researching blindness could actually be applied to testing for the coronavirus.
I'm a molecular geneticist and medical geneticist, and they were closing laboratories here at the university so people could socially isolate. And I realized that I had everything in my laboratory that would be needed to do COVID-19 testing. And so perhaps I could just test people in my laboratory. And so that's how we started. However, there was a shortage of nasal swabs for testing. So then we said, well, why should we use swabs at all? Maybe we could just have people spit. When people are swabbing, they shove this probe through the nose all the way to the back of the throat, and that's where they collect cells from. Well, what if we have people just sort of snort through their nose and then get everything into the front of their mouth as spit/sputum? and then they spit that into a container, and then we test that. And so we did that on a bunch of uninfected people, and our data showed we get these cells that are the cells that would be infected with the virus if people were infected. We have both positive controls that show we could detect the virus, and we have a negative controls that shows we shouldn't detect the virus if it's not there. And we got assistance from a wonderful physician here at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He could ask patients who have COVID-19 whether they would be interested in enrolling in our study. And so we've tested them. We've shown that our collection method works extremely well. We're at least 30 for 30. And we've also enrolled known negative people who were tested, and we've tested them, and we're 30 for 30 in demonstrating that they're negative.
So far the test has worked 100% of the time.
Correct. So the next step for us is to go to the Food and Drug Administration and get official approval to use our test, at least on an emergency basis, during this COVID-19 pandemic.
How long does that usually take to get approval like that?
Regular FDA approval can take months to years. With this emergency usage, you're supposed to be able to get approval within, say, a few weeks to a couple of months.
What goes into making the test?
Making the test, I would say, means everything both upstream and downstream of actually performing the test. So you've got to have all the tubes and containers. There's a liquid solution that kills the virus, and it preserves the RNA from the virus that you're actually looking for. And so getting all those things together, deliverable, and then get the samples in from patients, get them to a laboratory, have all the machinery to process them rapidly, keeping track of all the test results and delivering the test results to the patients and their physicians. So all that takes a lot of coordination. And so right now, I could probably scale up in my laboratory to doing maybe 500 to 1,000 tests a day. Delivering the results would be a process that we still have to figure out. Our goal is to get the FDA approval and then start doing some testing in our laboratory that will demonstrate that it's doable at a larger scale than we're currently doing.
Obviously, this is a product, so to speak, that has a huge, huge market.
I'm not in this for any money. There's been other spit tests developed out there from Rutgers University and some company, and their solution and everything is proprietary. I want everything open source so that anybody can use it.
Why don't you want to make money off of it?
I'm really not in it for the money. My life has been about doing research. I'm a physician, take care of patients. And if we can use our stuff to help with a pandemic, even in a little way or a local way, that's better than money. Some of the frustrating things why I wanted to get into this is that, for example, we heard that in Cedar Rapids, there were elderly care facilities, you know, residential care facilities, that were having relatively large outbreaks of their staff and residents, and they weren't getting tested fast enough. And I've got a 93-year-old mother-in-law that lives in such a nice residence here in Iowa City, where they had two staff members test positive. I asked myself, why isn't somebody testing everybody in such situations so they can stop the progression of the virus in such facilities? So we potentially hope to to target specific places and being able to help.
Thank you for speaking with me, Dr. Sheffield.
Well, thank you, Ursula.
This is Ursula Rudenberg reporting for Pacifica Radio Network from Iowa.
Comedian Lee Camp brings humor to some very serious issues, such as price gouging when it comes to coronavirus treatment.
Remdesivir, that's our savior, right? Sounds like the name of a hobbit in Middle Earth, but it's a drug that everyone is acting like will save us from COVID-19. And all will be well in the world with water parks and restaurants and random no-holds-barred makeouts. A world where when someone sneezes, we don't all dive under our desks. It'll be magical. There's only one problem. The big pharma company, Gilead, that owns Remdesivir, they've already announced their plans to profiteer from this pandemic. Drug maker Gilead says it's doing you a favor by setting the price for its pending COVID-19 treatment, Remdesivir, at more than $2,000 for government agencies and at over $3,000 for private insurers. $3,000 for a single treatment to possibly survive coronavirus. How does the CEO of Gilead, Daniel O'Day, justify this disgusting practice? He said they're underpricing Remdesivir. In normal circumstances, we would price a medicine according to the value it provides. Earlier hospital discharge would result in hospital savings of approximately $12,000 per patient. The value it provides? So that would mean if a doctor saves someone's life with heart surgery, then that guy owes the doctor the entire worth of the rest of his life? Millions of dollars? Maybe he should just be the surgeon's butler. Ah, fuck, my bill says butler. Well, kids, I'll see you. Daddy owes his life to another family now. Good luck on childhood. But this story gets crazier. Not only is it way overpriced, we're not even sure Remdesivir does much. There are some studies showing it does almost nothing. Meanwhile, according to The Intercept, another COVID-19 treatment has quietly been shown to be more effective. Although neither option appears to be the much-needed cure for COVID-19, a three-drug regimen offered a greater reduction in the time it took patients to recover than Remdesivir did. People who took the combination of interferon beta-1b, lopinavir, ritonavir, and ribavirin got better in 7 days as opposed to 12 days for those who didn't take it. Yet there's no mad rush to get those drugs. Why is that? Maybe it's due at least in part to the fact that that treatment hasn't been the subject of a major marketing campaign. No marketing campaign? How are people supposed to irrationally demand your medicines if there aren't at least 80,000 commercials telling them to do so? Each of the three drugs in the new combination is generic or no longer under patent, which means that no company stands to profit significantly from its use. Right. That's why there's no marketing campaign. Only the insanely, ridiculously profitable drugs are worth hyping. The cheap ones that simply save lives, those are garbage. What's the point of saving a life if you can't make a bundle from it? I've always said a life saved without extracting a shitload of money from it is a life worth losing. I don't know that this last part needs saying, but I'm going to do it anyway. When you have a system built on profit, run by sociopaths, based on manipulation and lizard brain impulses, then you will always end up in a race to the bottom. With unfettered capitalism, you will end up with the worst drugs priced at the highest amounts, hoarded by those who need them the least. Unless you're talking about recreational illegal drugs, those are better and cheaper than ever. Thank God for that.
We just heard Lee Camp, host of the comedy show Redacted Tonight. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
How well I do remember how class struggle brought me through. I went out on strike in 32. And they brought the thugs against me, and the state militia too, and they kicked me in the gutter. How about you? How about you? How about you? Can't you see this system's rotten through and through? It gives millions to the bosses, the capitalistic few, but enslaves the toiling masses like me and you. We need a brand new system, that's one thing that is true. A boss will have to work like me and you. And we'll all have homes to live in and a job to work at too. But there'll be no boss to rob us, me and you. How about you? How about you? Can't you see this system's rotten through and through? It gives millions to the bosses, the capitalistic few, but enslaves the toiling masses like me and you.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Hamid Khan. Houston, Texas has become an epicenter of coronavirus cases. Producer Akua Holt with Pacifica Radio KPFD has the details.
This virus is out of control in Houston.
Mayor Sylvester Turner stated in a recent press conference that the coronavirus is running rampant.
If we don't act to get it under control, very bad, extremely bad things will happen. Sickness, death, our economy progressively getting shut in.
He shared new data to support this position regarding COVID-19, including new cases and recent deaths. Houston has over 34,000 coronavirus cases. Mayor Turner also called out businesses that have violated capacity limits. Between Memorial Day and mid-June, Texas hospitalization rate drastically increased.
We're seeing a trend towards a younger population, both in our community testing as well as who is being admitted to our hospitals.
The mayor continues to ask Houstonians to shelter in place, wear masks, stay home, and avoid large crowds. That includes family cookouts, pool parties, and other social gatherings. Meanwhile, Annette Rodriguez, Director of Public Health for Corpus Christi in Nueces County, about 200 miles from Houston, says 85 babies under the age of one have all tested positive for COVID-19.
These babies have not even had their first birthday yet. Please help us to stop the spread of this disease.
Nueces County has the fastest growing in new cases on the 7-day average than any other metropolitan county in the state. Corpus Christi has about 8,000 coronavirus cases and 82 deaths linked to the virus, according to local officials. CNN reported other Texas counties such as Cameron and Hidalgo are also dire. Health officials are stocking up on refrigerated trucks to store bodies as morgues fill up. According to a report by The Intercept, more than 100 Houston area doctors, medical professions, and emergency room physicians have signed their names to a letter condemning Republican Congressman Danielle Crenshaw for spreading misinformation.
As far as hospitalizations go in Houston, one of the hardest hit places in Texas, our growth rate in hospitalizations has almost flattened. Now, that's a few days of good trends. It could change, and we have to be cautious and continue to wear our masks, socially distance, and not gather in large groups. But the trend is going in the right direction. Our death rate in Texas continues to be one of the best in the world.
Crenshaw represents Texas' 2nd District, which includes the north and west areas of Houston. In November, he will face Democratic challenger Nima Lajibardian, an attorney and former advisor to Beto O'Rourke. The race is one of the seven Texas House seats that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has deemed most competitive and possible to flip. I'm Akua Holt, reporting from Houston, Texas.
We now go to David Zirin and Eaton Thomas with the collision, sports and politics. From Pacifica Radio, WPFW in Washington, D.C., their story of the week has to do with the R word.
Let me ask you this. Have you been following the latest twists and turns with the name change of the Washington football team?
I have been following. I mean, if it's the last 24 hours with another twist, I don't know. I would like the Red Tails would be a cool name. I do see Amazon is dropping out along with all the others. And what I think is what Daniel Snyder is doing is probably looking at his balance sheet. And when he goes in the red and keeping the name turns into negative money, then he'll find religion.
You see, I wonder about that. And this is the thing, you know, because let's talk about where the corporations are at this point.
Okay.
Nike, not having, you can't buy the gear through the Nike website anymore. Mm-hmm. Target, like the Target right by my house, they've taken them off the shelf. Unbelievable. Used to have a huge display. Walmart, not selling the Washington football gear anymore. You mentioned Amazon just now. You got 40% of the team's ownership trying to get out because working with Dan Snyder has just become too bothersome and too loathsome. I mean, see, FedEx, of course, coming in. Now, these corporations didn't, this is my analysis, they didn't just find religion all of a sudden. They didn't just decide, my goodness, it's so important for us to be on the right side of history. No, I mean, what's happened, and this is why I've talked to leading Native American activists, and they share this analysis, is that the Black Lives Matter movement, this 50-state national uprising against racism, has just completely rearranged everything. And these corporations have decided that if they're going to connect with a younger generation that is not only less white than older generations, but also more left-wing, less tolerant of intolerance.
Yes.
You know, the base of Bernie, if you will. You know, these folks are not going to put up with racist team names like the Washington football team. And so that's why this is happening. But here's the real issue. Here's the kicker. What the heck is Dan Snyder going to do? Because I don't think Dan Snyder is motivated by money. I think he's motivated by ego. And if he thinks that his ego is being trapped in a corner and he has to do whatever the mob says he has to do and all the rest of it. You know, Donald Trump came out strongly for the name earlier this week. If Dan Snyder even feels a little bit of a wind at his back, I mean, come on now. This whole thing can change very quickly. That's what I think anyway. I don't trust Dan Snyder as far as I could throw him. I've said it once. I've said it a million times. He's George Costanza with hair. He's the Seinfeld character. He's, you know, he has nothing but these kind of pressing, sweaty insecurities. There's this whole weird dynamic where he doesn't want to change the name because his father wouldn't have wanted him to change the name. And it's all very wrought and psychological and Freudian. And I don't have a lot of faith. I really don't. Until that team takes the field with a new name, I don't have faith in it. The Red Tails would be very cool. No doubt about it. But I don't care what the name is, as long as it, A, isn't connected in any way, shape, or form to Native American imagery. You know, don't want him calling him the Washington Arrows or something like that. And B, that it gets done. So that's my take on this whole thing, man.
I mean, I can't say you're wrong. You sound like you know the psyche of Dan Snyder better than I do.
God, I've spent 20 years, unfortunately, mired in this guy's head.
Well, I know, and you wrote a book on sports owners and very flattering depictions of Snyder. But I'm not saying you're wrong, and I don't know what's in his head. Let me just find a middle ground right here. The name change begins with him losing money on it. And then, so if he starts to lose money by not changing the name, then it's okay, it's about his ego. But if he has an ego and they're still making money off the name, then there's nothing to talk about. So the conversation begins with him losing money, like most conversations, and then we'll take it from there. I believe if he loses enough money, he may want to swallow his ego. Billionaires didn't become billionaires generally by turning down opportunities to make a lot of money, though you know Snyder better than I do.
No, but you're making a good point, of course. And so we're going to see what those competing pressures produce in Dan Snyder. But, you know, one of the things that I've always said is that, you know, this name cannot withstand scrutiny. It just can't. I thought this name would change 7-8 years ago for the simple reason that I thought Robert Griffin III was going to be so good that the team would advance deep into the playoffs on a year-in, year-out basis. And the scrutiny that would accompany that would make the name untenable. The same way right now, there's a serious discussion about the Kansas City Chiefs changing their name. Wow. And one of the reasons for that is, of course, the movement. But another reason is that they just won the Super Bowl. And so it forces people to think about these things. Think about mascotting. Think about who it hurts. Think about who it helps. And, you know, one of the big lies that Snyder likes to push is that the name means too much to the people of the Washington, D.C. area.
That's garbage.
That is such garbage. You know, one of my favorite little facts about the D.C. area, particularly Black D.C., is that the Dallas Cowboys are actually the second most popular team. And that, did you know that? That statistically, the Cowboys were number two, the great rival of the Washington football team?
Not only did I not know that, I could almost say I'm shocked by it.
Yeah, it's true. I'm talking pure polls and statistics. And one of the reasons why that's the case is that that's rooted in families that have lived in D.C. for 3-4 generations. And they remember George Preston Marshall, the owner of the team, who is a white supremacist. And they rooted for the team that Washington hated for the simple reason that, you know, like, what is the opposite of the Washington football team? It's the Dallas Cowboys. Sure as night is the opposite of day. And they rooted for that team as a statement of loving football and hating racism. I mean, you go into a bar in the D.C. area when the Cowboys in Washington play and you see a lot of that silver star. Let me tell you.
No, that's right. I mean, they're all around the country. I'm told it's America's team. Who knows? Maybe it is. But listen, we always talk about Daniel Snyder, as we should. But like Dave Zirin, Chuck Modiano, we can't really control Daniel Snyder. But we can put pressure in other areas. And what do we both work in? We work in the field of sports journalism. And there's some places, you know, I write for Deadspin. They don't use the DC name. I previously wrote for New York Daily News. In the middle of the way, they said, we're going to stop using DC name, the R word. We can pressure every single sports outlet because there's still many who still use it. So even within our sphere, I think we have to put pressure to stop promoting that name until every sports outlet, another outlet, stops using the R word.
Our thanks to the hosts and producers of The Collision, Sports and Politics, a show that airs on WBFW-FM in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy with Hamid Khan. According to the Garment Workers Center, a Los Angeles-based workers' rights organization, around 45,000 people are employed in the Los Angeles garment manufacturer industry, the largest of its kind in the United States. When COVID-19 hit Southern California, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti sought to partner up manufacturers with retailers to produce highly needed personal protective equipment, or PPE. However, garment workers are reportedly sewing masks in factories known for wage theft and unsafe working conditions. Pacifica Radio producer Paulina Vasiliev spoke to Alex Sanchez, field organizer with LA's Garment Workers Center.
The industry has had issues for the longest time. I grew up as a son of a garment worker. My mom was a garment worker for over 20 years, and I remember as a child being at these garment work factories, but it was still heavily unionized in the 70s. But what we've noticed is that the industry has been forgotten. The factories that are all over here in LA, which is the hub of fast fashion, are rodent infested, missing just the basic health and safety protections that any worker should have. So they're not climate controlled, they're rodent infested. One restroom for over sometimes 50, 100 workers. There are not any clean eating facilities for breaks and lunches. We see workers that are constantly paid a piece rate which equals $6 to $7 an hour, which is way almost less than double of what minimum wage should be. We're putting in 60 to 70 hours a week, getting paid $200 for that week. There are so many conditions and bad conditions, and also these workers have no health care. They also have no sick leave. So most of these workers continue to work when they're sick. And these are the conditions that were evident that were prior to COVID. Now with COVID in place, now you are having these facilities that should have social distancing, hand washing and sanitizing stations, and also should be monitoring for COVID-like symptoms, and it's not happening.
Why is that this work considered essential is being still invisibilized? And I want you to comment especially on the fact that, at least in Los Angeles, the garment industry, the manufacturing of garments, and in this case, masks, relies in large part on undocumented workers.
Well, I think you hit it on the head right there. I think, first of all, what we're seeing is that there's not enough inspection or inspectors for the amount of workers that and workplaces here in LA and throughout the state due to budget cuts or just because those positions haven't been filled. But then you also have a workforce that does not speak out. It might be due to fear, or it might be due to threats that are made to them at the workplace. So they start seeing that folks are sick around them, and that's their only way to get an income because they don't have any type of sick time or they're not eligible for work comp. So many of these workers will stay quiet and work sick because if they don't work, their family doesn't eat. So that's probably the reason why a lot of these places are not, there's no active reporting where somebody else that maybe has the ability to go on work comp or look for another job would report their workplace.
What are you calling for and what campaigns would you like our listeners to know about?
So we currently have a bill that's in legislation. The bill was authored by Senator Maria Elena Durazo. The bill is SB 1399. What SB 1399 would do would be to eliminate the piece rate in the garment industry. That means every garment factory would be held accountable to paying minimum wage. And I know that when we bring that up, some people are shocked, saying, wait, there's minimum wage laws already in place. What's going on? Well, the way the garment industry works is that they use an outdated piece rate, which is supposed to be equal to or be above minimum wage, but garment factories have got around that and they have just gotten to start paying a piece rate. And if workers make too much, they'll lower the piece rate. So SB 1399 would say there is no more piece rate. Everybody needs to get paid by the hour, by whatever the wage is in the county or the city or the state, but also would hold big brands accountable so these minimum wage laws would so these factories would deal with these minimum wage laws. We need to see where these masks are going. So if there's a factory here in LA that's producing 10, 15,000 masks, we need to be able to have the transparency to see who the purchaser is, where the bills of lading are going for transportation and logistics. So there has to be more transparency as well to see who is the one that's ultimately paying for these masks.
What should people be aware of, and what should they be talking to their elected officials about?
I think it's important that whether workers are deemed essential or either workers that are deemed non-essential, it's important that everybody has health and safety in their workplace. It's important that you get home safely the same way you arrived. And there are a lot of manufacturing companies, garment and non-garment, that are not adhering to these standards, whether it's your Amazons. We just seen a report on Tesla. So I think that health and safety needs to be the most important thing before we start talking about shareholder value or these golden parachutes that the CEOs get, or the kind of wage packages we see that upper management get. We need to start worrying about the workers that are the backbone of these industries and of our country.
In fact, one of our most famous political prisoners, Mumia Abu-Jamal, in a recent interview from prison, spoke of disposable labor instead of essential labor. This denomination is essential worker almost a joke.
I believe that he spoke eloquently. I think that's exactly that. That we tag some workers as essential and not others as non-essential, or they're not essential because they don't have the documentation that's needed, is nonsense. Every worker is essential. We need to treat workers as essential, and we need to stop treating workers as disposable income or disposable machines or disposable labor. We need to treat workers as essential, and we need to understand what their importance is in our economy and our country.
Alex Sanchez with the Garment Workers Center in Los Angeles. Thank you so much for speaking with Pacifica Radio today.
Thank you very much, Paulina.
That was Paulina Vasilia reporting for Pacifica Radio. We now hear from poet Raymond Nat Turner.
This piece is called Essential Work. We'll always need race car drivers roaring down streets where children chase balls. Like we'll always need peaceful protesters pepper sprayed like cockroaches. And we'll always need sleeping seven-year-olds shot while dreaming of dolls, sleepovers, tooth fairies. We'll always need children playing with toy guns in parks, executed before becoming Hulk Hogan's. We'll always need doors kicked in and our daughters and sons slaughtered in wee hours, even if it is the wrong address. We'll always need elderly parents whacked for accidentally pressing emergency alerts. Like we'll always need mentally ill loved ones massacred in their homes. We'll always need men rushing pregnant wives to hospitals shot for speeding, and fathers of six hustling too hard, chokehold lynched. We'll always need young women who drive and smoke, stopped and suicided, and mothers wearing masks wrong, wrestled down in subway stations as their four-year-olds watch. We'll always need wallets mistaken for guns, Glocks for tasers, fleeing black men shot in their backs, and bridegrooms butchered night before their weddings. We'll always need tasered hearts skanking in reggae rhythms, and broken broomsticks rammed up men's rectums for fun. We'll always need bruised, bloody, disfigured faces, eyeballs dangling from sockets. We'll always need drugs and guns planted, growing into cases, concertina wire, COVID-19. We'll always need right hooves raised, testifying to judges and juries of peers on the need for knees on necks. 56 licks or 41 shots served to protect property.
That was poet Raymond Nat Turner.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's special national broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Hamid Khan. The two faces of state violence: murder by law enforcement and medical apartheid. The United States state-sanctioned violence is responsible for the protests we see today. This violence is institutionalized through racist ideas such as anti-black racism and practices such as policing, militarism, and surveillance. It is made up of structures such as jails, juvenile halls, detention centers, and uses both people, police, ICE officers and soldiers, and technologies, databases and applications to maintain its power at the cost of communities. In this current pandemic, structural violence helps explain how the country has been unable and unwilling to develop a public health system that can both prevent death and disability, and prevent certain lives from being disposable. Through structural racism, this violence is enacted unevenly across communities. If you're black, brown, or poor, you're disproportionately overrepresented in COVID-related death, hospitalizations, or infections. Obesity and diabetes are not to blame for these disparities. Rather, structural racism and continued barriers to establishing an effective community health systems are. This form of medical apartheid, or violent racialized negligence, converges with ever-expanding policing and surveillance of black, brown, and poor communities. Historically, there has always been points of convergence. Currently, policing and public health surveillance technologies are emerging as responses to the spread of COVID-19 via increased profiling and arrests of people of color, particularly of black people for not following public health mandates. And the increased investment in private surveillance, businesses tracking people's behavior and health data. The continuing devaluation of black and brown life drives government priorities in broader ways, with financial health of corporations being prioritized over the communities of color, who comprise an outsized share of our essential workforce. To accomplish this, the multiple health systems positioned to manage the illnesses are the same systems that produce worse health outcomes for black and brown people and have failed to equip healthcare workers with sufficient protective equipment and testing. Relatedly, these systems are entangled with private profit motives, which have left people in a pandemic without consistent access to quality healthcare, thereby participating in their state-sanctioned premature death. Similar to 9/11 and other crisis moments in history, the policing apparatus is ushering in techno-solutionism. Guided by the idea that private technologies and expanded surveillance can manage our biologies. This is clear in the role of these new technologies or technological tools to enhance public health surveillance practices, data collection, analysis, and sharing. Besides Apple and Google launching sweeping new contract tracing applications, there's Palantir, known for bolstering the police surveillance systems and the federal deportation machinery, which is contracted by the Department of Health and Human Services to help the government create HSS Protect Now, a data platform to track COVID plus patients. Undeniably, law enforcement's powers, surveillance, militarization, and funding have expanded post 9/11. In 2004, the Intelligence Reform Terrorism Prevention Act mandated the president to create an information sharing environment, instigating a new culture and infrastructure of data sharing across all law enforcement agencies. Law enforcement became not only boots on the ground, but also the eyes and ears for the federal government, with loopholes allowing access and sharing of any data deemed relevant to national security in the war on terror. The federal government also emboldened the private sector to become the main conduits of data gathering, sharing, and analysis, which includes health data, seeing that the Department of Homeland Security has access to COVID-19 data. Alarms considering these technologies are largely framed as a privacy concern. However, considering the enhanced surveillance in already marginalized communities, it symbolizes how violence, racism, and health are interconnected. Surveillance data, whether it be health or crime data, cannot escape the fact that it is inherently political, not neutral, and is weaponized to contain, control, and criminalize certain communities. We see this in the racial disparities within algorithmic policing that target Black people and their communities, bail risk assessments that favor the pre-release of white people, and tech companies like PredPol that manipulate its system to track COVID plus people. These technologies come at a systemic, violent cost to community health, connection, and power, and have immediate consequences for Black, brown, and indigenous life. The protests today are responding to these costs. These solutions leave us skeptical if the responses developed in response to COVID are even designed to promote health. Already, the infrastructure for a larger local public health surveillance network built on racist ideology is underway. And this shift is happening in lieu of building a community-centered health system. The problem is not the execution of contact tracing itself, but what has moved into place to once again make public health a tool of state surveillance. This is presented on behalf of the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, and we thank Dr. Bita Amani, Jamie Garcia, David Sanchez, Mina Sharif, and Jen Alvarez for their contribution to this article.
The man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Paulina Vasilia. Special thanks to Verna Avery Brown at WPFW and to Fernando Velasquez at KPFK for advice and support. I'm Hamid Khan. Thanks for listening. You can find all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.